continues to impose an economic blockade on its impoverished neighbor. The kingdom's actions are also jeopardizing efforts for peace.
The ceasefire agreement is set to expire on October 2nd, and if not extended, could lead to the resumption of war. The Ansar Allah leader has already said that the Yemeni army and allied fighters are prepared for any scenario. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi gave his first speech at the United Nations General Assembly, filled with demands for multilateralism, justice, and peaceful logic. Following Iran's official admittance to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization last week, Raisi insisted that there is increasing progress towards cooperative internationalism and away from unilateralism. He decried the choice of capitalism over morality, saying such ideas have lost their legitimacy in public opinion. Raisi spoke of Iran's success in defeating the Daesh terrorist group, called for an end to Israel's 7 decades of ceaseless oppression against Palestinians, and demanded a fair trial and justice for the murderers of Iranian anti-terror hero General Qasem Soleimani in 2020. Raisi said, "The story of the Iranian nation is the story of a nation which stands on its own 2 feet. But the U.S. cannot accept this independence, which explains why, for Washington," Raisi said, "militarism is its security." The Iranian president then continued with more top-level bilateral meetings and also met with a group of analysts, academics, and members of think tanks. No progress appears to have been made this week to restart the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, regarding Iran's nuclear energy program. Iranian negotiations this week with Europe were reportedly tense as, for years, Europe has failed to honestly implement their side of the agreement. Tehran has said that they are willing to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs verifiable guarantees that Washington will not illegally and unilaterally withdraw from the accord again, as it did in May 2018. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history.
There is a strong disaffection with politics in Italy, but while in the elections held 5 years ago, the five-star movement was able to intercept people's anger and dissatisfaction. This time, there doesn't seem to be a party strong enough to do the same.
According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018.
I don't have faith in establishment politics, but I don't know who to vote for. At the same time, I think not voting could be even worse. I'm really undecided.
The truth is that I don't have much trust in politicians. Will they be able to keep their electoral pledges?
A few days ago, the U.S. government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the U.S. move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years.
I think the cabinet secretary with the security brief has already made clear that no Italian politicians nor political parties have received funding from Moscow. If Russia has meddled in elections held in foreign countries, it goes without saying the U.S. certainly did the same.
Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Tensions between British Hindus and Muslims have escalated recently, with the unrest mostly involving young men from both communities and leading to scuffles and assaults. On Tuesday, hundreds of masked Muslim men descended on a Hindu temple in Birmingham. Local Muslims were furious over a recent attempt by the temple to platform a hardline Indian preacher.
Things are a bit tasty here, but ultimately the reason that they've gathered in these numbers is because this centre was planning to platform a very notorious BJP representative who espouses the Hindutva fascist ideology, which is very prominent in India right now and is responsible for a lot of anti-Muslim hate crimes which have taken place there. That ideology has essentially been exported now, unfortunately, into the streets of Britain, and it's been leading up to the point over months.
Tuesday's unrest was sparked following a Hindu mob marching through Muslim-majority areas in the nearby city of Leicester on Saturday, chanting Hindutva slogans. Eyewitnesses say the marchers attacked local Muslim businesses and intimidated the community. Local police failed to stop the rally, which was later confronted by a crowd of Muslims. According to some reports, the violence flared up after a recent Asia Cup cricket match between arch-rivals India and Pakistan. However, Muslims in Leicester have been routinely targeted by Hindu thugs way before the match.
And they think they can do the same thing here what they can do in India. We've lived with Hindus for decades and never had any issues with them whatsoever until these guys came along. These young men came along. And they've caused so much grief here. And the most Muslims here are very peaceful. They've turned the other cheek for so long, turned the other cheek, called the police. Police haven't done anything. Their inaction has caused this. So I blame the police for this.
As UK police scramble to investigate many incidents, the feud has gone global, as India and Pakistan's high commissions issued passionate statements condemning either side of the divide, fading any hopes of a quick solution to the chaos. Robert Carter, Leicester.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil, holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né?
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing to Press TV how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This homeland requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kenitra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria, but thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risked their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attachés from different embassies, to attend this ceremony, dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
Time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sides in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carver was behind the wheel of a car, hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street, before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organizers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Modern history is a testament to the fact that no matter how great U.S. Western Israeli pressures and however weak or divided the Arabs are, Palestine will continue to reign supreme as the cause of all Muslims, says Ramzi Baruch, journalist, in an article published under the heading "Why Normalization with the Israeli Regime Will Fail." Stay tuned for more. It seemed all but a done deal. The Israeli regime is finally managing to bend the Arabs to its will, and Palestine is becoming a marginal issue that no longer defines the Zionist regime's relations with Arab countries. Indeed, normalization with the Zionist regime is afoot, and the Arabs, so it seems, have been finally tamed. Not so fast. Many events continue to demonstrate the opposite. Take, for example, the Arab League Today meeting in Cairo on July 31st to August 1st. The meeting was largely dominated by discussions on Palestine and concluded with a statement that called on Arab countries to reactivate the Arab boycott of the Israeli regime until the latter abides by international law. The strongest language came from the League's Assistant Secretary General, who called for solidarity with the Palestinian people by boycotting companies that support the Zionist regime's occupation. The two-day conference of the liaison officers of the Arab regional offices on the boycott of the Zionist regime praised the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement, which has been under intense Western pressures for its unrelenting advocacy of international action against the fake regime of Israel. One of the recommendations by Arab officials was to support Arab boycott initiatives in accordance with the Tunis Arab Summit in March 2019, which resolved that boycott of the Israeli regime occupation and its colonial regime is one of the effective and legitimate means to resist. Though one may rightly cast doubts on the significance of such statements in terms of dissuading the Zionist regime from its ongoing colonization schemes in Palestine, at least it demonstrates that in terms of political discourse, the collective Arab position remains unchanged. This was also expressed clearly to U.S. President Joe Biden during his latest visit to the West Asia region. Biden may have expected to leave the region with major Arab concession to the Zionist regime, which would be considered a significant political victory for the pro-Israel members of his Democratic Party prior to defining November midterm elections, but he received none. What American officials do not understand is that Palestine is a deeply rooted emotional, cultural, and spiritual issue for Arabs and Muslims. Neither Biden nor Donald Trump and Jared Kushner before him could easily or possibly alter that. Indeed, anyone who is familiar with the history of the centrality of Palestine in the Arab discourse understands that Palestine is not a mere political question that is governed by opportunism, an immediate political or geopolitical interest. Modern history is a testament to the fact that no matter how great U.S., Western, Israeli pressures and however weak or divided the Arabs are, Palestine will continue to reign supreme as the cause of all Muslims. Political platitudes aside, the Palestinian struggle for freedom remains a recurring theme in Arab poetry, art, sports, religion, and culture in all its manifestations. This is not an opinion, but a demonstrable fact. The latest Arab Center, Washington, D.C., ACW public opinion poll examined the views of 28,288 Arabs in 13 different countries. Majority of the 350 million Arabs continue to hold the same view as previous generations of Arabs did, as Palestine is a cause and the Zionist regime is the main threat. The Arab Opinion Index, AOI, of late 2020 is not the first of its kind. In fact, it is the seventh such study to be conducted since 2011. The trend remains stable. All the U.S.-Israeli plots and bribes to sideline Palestine and the Palestinians have failed, and despite purported diplomatic successes, they will continue to fail. According to the poll, vast majority of Arabs, about 81%, oppose U.S. policy towards Palestine. 89% and 81% believe that the Israeli regime and the U.S. respectively are the largest threat to their individual country's national security. Particularly important, majority of Arab respondents insist that the Palestinian cause concerns all Arabs and not simply the Palestinians. This includes 89% of Saudis and 88% of Qataris. Arabs may disagree on many issues, and they do. They might stand at opposite sides of regional and international conflicts, and they do. They might even go to war against one another, and sadly, they often do. But Palestine remains the exception. For Arabs, Palestine is also a personal and intimate subject. Numerous Arab households have framed photos of Arab martyrs who were killed by the Zionist regime during previous wars or were killed fighting for Palestine. This means that no amount of normalization or even outright recognition of the Zionist regime by an Arab country can wash away the Zionist regime's sordid past or menacing image in the eyes of ordinary Arabs. A most telling example of this is how Egyptians and Jordanians answered the AOI question, "Would you support or oppose diplomatic recognition of Israel by your country?" The interesting thing about this question is that both Cairo and Amman already recognized the Zionist regime and have diplomatic ties with Tel Aviv since 1979 and 1994, respectively. Still to this day, 93% of Jordanians and 85% of Egyptians still oppose that recognition as if it never took place. The argument that Arab public opinion carries no weight in non-democratic societies neglects the fact that every form of government is predicated on some form of legitimacy, if not through a direct vote. It is through other means. Considering the degree of involvement the cause of Palestine carries in every aspect of Arab societies, on the street, in the mosques and church, in universities, sports, civil society organizations, and much more, this owning Palestine would be a major delegitimizing factor and a risky political move. American politicians who are constantly angling for quick political victories on behalf of the Zionist regime in the West Asia region do not understand or simply do not care about marginalizing Palestine and incorporating the Zionist regime into the Arab body politic. It's not simply unethical, but also a major destabilizing factor in an already unstable region. Historically, such attempts have failed, and often miserably so, as apartheid Israeli regime remains as hated by those who normalized as much as it is hated by those who have not. Nothing will ever change that, as long as Palestine remains an occupied country.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The war between Russia and Ukraine is now in its ninth month, while people in four Ukrainian regions have started voting in referendums on joining Russia. Kiev claims to have expanded its territorial gains in the east. Moscow is now saying the West has become part of the war by supplying military aid and information to Kiev and is accusing the West of nuclear blackmail. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll discuss the latest developments of the conflict and the West's role in the prolongation of the war. Joining us on the program, we have activist and political analyst, and George Samueli, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute from London Metropolitan University, joining us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. Sir, the Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against its territorial integrity. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II. What is your perspective on the recent developments with regards to the Ukraine conflict?
Well, I think that President Putin has made it very clear that he's not bluffing in this matter whatsoever, and that he intends to proceed with the integration of the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine into the Russian Federation, as that seems to be the only way to protect them from a war of genocide by the Ukrainian government.
George Samueli, Putin is accusing Western countries of engaging in nuclear blackmail and trying to destroy Russia. Can you explain what he means by that term, nuclear blackmail?
Well, I think that he means that the Western powers are essentially threatening Russia with nuclear war and thereby warning Russia away from continuing its ongoing military operations. But I think what he is really getting at here is that Russia will do whatever is necessary to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity. And as Mr. Bosnich pointed out, following the referendums and the inevitable incorporation of these territories within the Russian Federation, that means henceforth any attacks on those territories will be regarded as attacks on the Russian Federation. And Russia has now said that we will respond with all means at our disposal on any attack on our territorial integrity.
John Bosnich speaking at the United Nations Security Council. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were parties to the conflict, adding that, quote, the intentional fomenting of this conflict by the collective West remained unpunished. The question is, will this support that Western countries are giving Ukraine result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
Well, that's always a possibility because the NATO powers seem to have lost their heads. They don't realize the seriousness of this situation. Ukraine cannot be seen without reference to Russia. Ukraine, the current territory known as Ukraine, was in fact the first settlement area of the Russian nation. There was a country called Rus, which was headquartered and its capital was Kiev. And so the fact that this conflict is taking place around Kiev and around the original historic heartland of the Russian people is indicative of how central and how important this is to the current Russian government in Moscow. The Western powers, for some reason, seem to think that a line drawn on a map has created in Ukraine some kind of a Western-oriented NATO military colony. They are so wrong that it can't be put into words.
George Samuel in Budapest, speaking at the United Nations General Assembly, U.S. President Joe Biden strongly denounced Russia's invasion of Ukraine, warning U.N. member states that, quote, if a nation can pursue imperial ambitions without consequences, then we put at risk everything this great institution stands for. It sounds like the kettle calling the pot black.
Yeah, it does indeed. And of course, what Biden said, and it's said repeated ad nauseum by the other NATO leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Liz Truss, Olaf Scholz, I will say the same thing, is that Russia, out of the blue, attacked Ukraine, unprovoked, unjustified aggression against the neighbor. This, of course, is completely untrue. Because, of course, this conflict has been going on for a considerable amount of time, at least for 8 years since essentially Ukraine launched a war against its own Russian-speaking population and failed to implement an agreement that was reached at Minsk I agreement, Minsk II agreement, which was in fact incorporated within a UN Security Council resolution. So this was a UN Security Council resolution that supposedly the Western powers supported, but in fact did nothing whatever to coerce Kiev to attempt to implement. In fact, Kiev has admitted, or the former President Poroshenko admitted, that he was never had the slightest intention to implement Minsk. He was instead just buying time pretending to be interested in implementing an agreement, but actually using the time to become stronger and stronger. And NATO willingly cooperated with this, pouring in arms for 8 years into Ukraine with a view, obviously, to mounting basically a genocidal campaign against the Russian-speaking population, meaning they would just simply had the plan to drive them out altogether. So, but of course, that disappears from the view of the Western leaders, who just simply go back to the story. Oh, Russia just one day woke up and decided to attack Ukraine. Nothing at all happened beforehand. So, what Biden says is the way Western media and Western politicians interpret what's going on. Completely untrue.
John Bozich, the European Union is planning to impose new sanctions against Russia. The EU High Representative added Europe will continue to support Ukraine and provide it with military equipment as long as needed. Surely this will send ripple effects up and down the global market again. Tell us more about the ramifications of these measures and its repercussions for Europe, especially as winter approaches.
Well, I certainly wouldn't just call it ripple effects. I would call it a reverse tsunami. Yeah, exactly. Okay. What we've got here is every sanction that the Western powers, I prefer to call them just the American military colonies, in effect. Every sanction they put on Russia is going to boomerang and hit them back twice as hard as it hits Russia. Russia has secured an export market for its primary export product, which is petroleum products, and the buyer is China. And China is not just a passive buyer. China is also a strong military power, which has an interest in maintaining the strength and integrity of Russia. So in every sanction that the Western military alliance puts on Russia, they are tightening the cooperation between Russia and China, and Russia and other countries such as Iran, which is attempting to pursue its own independent development. That's point one. Point number two, under the current regime of sanctions, the energy crisis in Europe has reached such a stage that the European economies are going to collapse. When the European economies collapse, the people of Europe are going to look at their leaders and ask them, are you the leaders of our nations, or are you nothing more than American marionettes? If the public of Europe comes to the conclusion that their ruling class are all marionettes of a foreign power, we could see the collapse of the post-World War II U.S.-controlled European structures. And if that happens, this situation would not be a war, but it would be a tectonic shift of power in the entire world.
George Samuel, British Prime Minister Liz Truss has announced that in the following year, the U.K. will meet or exceed the amount of military aid spent on Ukraine in 2022. Is the U.K. in a position right now, in your opinion, to splash more money on military assistance to Ukraine rather than focus on its own economic troubles? Apart from that, interestingly, a British MP has said spending more on military aid to Ukraine will cut energy bills. How is that possible?
Well, of course, it isn't possible. And as you say, the U.K. does not have this kind of money. And the only way it can do so is if it starts printing money. But given that inflation in the UK is already on course to be around 20% by January, there is just simply no way that the UK can come up with this sort of money. But the issue, however, is a more serious one than that, because if the UK does indeed throw in this heavy military hardware into Ukraine, and this hardware is going to be used on Russian people, which is what's going to happen if Ukraine is going to continue with its war, then, of course, UK is explicitly a party to this war, and therefore the consequences could be quite serious for the UK. But almost certainly, Russia will respond by cutting off all energy exports to Europe altogether. I mean, it's not just going to be, well, it'll be 20% or 30% or whatever. It's going to be 0%. And when that happens, then I think the European economies will just come tumbling down. I mean, German economy is already, and that's the powerhouse of Europe, is already in a very precarious position. And once it's completely cut off, I think there's just going to be a complete collapse within Europe, and then we'll see what the political consequences will be, because this is an entirely unnecessary war in the first place, and it was entirely unnecessary for the European powers to get themselves into a war that had nothing to do with them and did not in any way threaten their security. So they've got themselves into this absolute catastrophe for no intelligible reason whatsoever. And I would indeed expect that there would be enormous political ramifications.
Mr. Bozich, let's put some focus on events on the ground. Ukraine claims to have reclaimed major swaths of territory with its counteroffensives, forcing Russian troops to retreat. I want to get your thoughts on that. Do you think it's due to the assistance that it's getting from the U.S. and its allies? And is this just what the U.S. and the NATO wants, this conflict to be a prolonged one, to see it dragged out for as long as possible in the hopes that it weakens Russia?
When the military historians look back on this conflict, they are going to praise the Russian generals and the Russian general staff for the brilliant way in which they pursued the battle. The recent gains, so-called gains by the Ukrainian army, especially in the northeastern region around Kharkov, have been taken at the expense of several hundred Russian soldiers and the loss of more than 4,700 Ukrainian soldiers. We're talking a death count up to 20 times higher on the Ukrainian side. And what they've achieved is they've inherited an area of empty ground with no resources and nothing of any value. What has happened here is Russia has arranged a strategic withdrawal which drew in a Ukrainian army, their best reserves, put them on an open plain, and allowed them to be destroyed from the air. Now, this is what Russia could have done to the city of Kiev at the beginning of the war and chose not to do in the interests of finding a negotiated solution. Now that Kiev has made it clear, and the NATO colonies, NATO military colonies in the EU, have backed it up, it looks like time for real war. Real war means that Russia is going to withdraw its strategic reserves from other areas and put them into the battle. Now, Russia is a country of 145 million people. It can easily put another 300,000 men in the field, and these are not green recruits. These are people who have already gone through military training and have served in the Russian military. Ukraine has no such recruits available. It will be a walkover if it becomes a full-scale war. And if it's a walkover, this is not just the defeat of Ukraine, but the defeat of NATO. And we can see the very, very high possibility that NATO itself will fracture and will lose member countries, starting with Romania and Hungary.
George Samuel, your referendums on joining Russia are due to take place from today until Tuesday in several largely Russian-held regions in the east and in the south of Ukraine, which, as a matter of fact, comprise around 15% of the country's territory. Ukraine and its allies have said that such votes would be illegal. The UN chief also has expressed concerns over the referendums. What is your take on the issue of these referendums being held?
Well, we can be pretty sure that the referendum will be overwhelmingly in favor of joining the Russian Federation. We also know that the constitutional process of incorporating these territories within the Russian Federation will be accomplished very quickly. If you remember how it was with Crimea in 2014, it was done very quickly. So the State Duma will pass appropriate legislation, and then President Putin will sign it, and these territories will be a part of Russia. And of course, it now means that Ukraine will be targeting, if it continues the war, and it says it intends to continue the war, the NATO powers, all of them have said, yeah, nothing changes. We don't care about any referendum. We're going to continue doing everything that we've been doing. Well, that means that they are ready to escalate to a full-scale war with Russia. And, of course, Russia, you know, can easily insert this 300,000 reserves. And more. It's a big country. The casualties that Russia has sustained so far are vastly dwarfed by the casualties sustained by Ukraine, which is, you know, about a third, maybe even about a quarter of Russia's size. So as Russia escalates, Ukraine has no means of escalating because it's already sustained casualties. Now, the Russians have estimated that Ukrainians have lost about 60,000 killed in action. That may be true or may not be true. We don't know for sure, but most estimates are in that ballpark. So Ukraine doesn't have any additional manpower that it can draw upon other than if NATO were to get directly involved themselves. Well, you know, this is the time for, you know, NATO to put up or shut up. I mean, having said all this time, well, we're not directly involved in this war, we're not party to it. Well, you know, Kyiv is going to turn to them and say, okay, are you ready to get directly involved? I suspect that they're not, in which case they will have no choice but to tell Kyiv it's time to knock it up. Now, it's possible that they're so stupid and they're so crazy that they will get involved directly. Unfortunately, for NATO, they're not really in any position in that part of Europe to wage any kind of a war against Russia. It's a hell of a big undertaking for them to get kind of manpower into Ukraine.
John Bosnich, John. Final question to you in retrospect. Could the U.S. and NATO, could have acted differently to de-escalate the situation altogether? Russia put forth its request that Ukraine can't join NATO, and no more eastward expansion of the military alliance. What do you think?
Well, in fact, they can't do that because the sole purpose of NATO is to drive to the east, or as Hitler and the Kaisers before him called it, Drang nach Osten. It's a perpetual desire of the Central European powers grouped around the former Austro-Hungarian Empire and Imperial Germany. This is the fundamental reason for NATO. And when I look at the data here, it's not that NATO has become involved in this war. NATO is this war. Zelensky is NATO's puppet. Ukraine is a victim of NATO's foreign policy. And when I look at the list of what charges can be laid against the NATO leadership, I don't even know where one would start. Torture, ethnic cleansing, genocide, Nazi revanchism, the creation and violation of media rights, and the fundamental violation of the human rights of not only the ethnic Russian citizens of Ukraine, but the ethnic Ukrainian citizens of Ukraine who've been tricked and cheated into a war that should have never taken place. Where the prosecution will begin, I don't know. But where it will end, I do know. In Kyiv.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, journalists, activists, and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade, and also senior.